Well, hey, Jamie, welcome to West Coast Project for our podcast on Fifi, Better Call Saul.
Thank you.
How are you doing tonight, Jamie?
I'm doing okay, Mike. How are you doing?
All right. We caught it at the beginning this time. I'm very well. Thank you for asking.
Well, that is good news.
This is 208, Jamie. We're almost done with this season.
I know. It's so weird. It feels like it just got started.
You know, Jamie, I was thinking I could see Kim walking into that Cinnabon in the final episode of this whole series and creating a surprise encounter with Jimmy.
I could see that black and white scene turning over to, like, show, you know, like, manager of the month or, you know, something like that, and having Kim's picture be on the wall.
She's going to be working there, too, you think?
Maybe.
Oh, that would be depressing.
No, not really. I mean, really kind of apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic, you know, true love kind of Romeo Juliet way. It'd be kind of sweet.
That they each had each other in their misery?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. It just, they had to put Kim on the border of Nebraska for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, there's something there.
Gotta be.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jamie, how did you like the opening shot, the tracking shot?
The opening shot.
Of the truck, the...
Oh, okay, God. Okay. All right, so I was lost in thought for a second. I was thinking about... What is it that Jimmy said recently? He said in, like, one of those episodes recently, something about worst-case scenario, best-case scenario. Do you remember him saying something about that?
I think he said that more than once, hasn't he?
He has, but the reason I'm bringing it up is because you brought up Kim and the, you know, Nebraska, that, like, the Kansas-Nebraska border or whatever, and I was just remembering what he said to Walt when they were in the Disappearer's dungeon, whatever that place was. He said, best case scenario, you know, however long from now I'm in a Cinnabon in Omaha, you know, with two pairs of Dockers or whatever, I don't know. And, you know, it's kind of interesting if you start thinking best case scenario for him, you know, maybe he's working in Kim's Cinnabon. I don't know.
Interesting. There's a quick Google search of worst case scenario pulls up Gus telling Gail that Walter's diagnosis is reaching, is reaching critical levels, and he must prepare for the worst case scenario.
yeah, that sounds about right. So I guess that's, oh yeah, and oh, this episode we got our first patented Breaking Bad up from the ground cam. Did you see it?
Yeah. Well, hold on a second, Jamie. For your thanks to technology and for your listening pleasure. Give me a second here.
Okay.
Hey, I'm a civilian. I'm not your lawyer anymore. I'm nobody's lawyer. The fun's over. From here on out, I'm Mr. Low Profile. Just another douchebag with a job and three pairs of Dockers. If I'm lucky, a month from now, best case scenario, I'm managing a Cinnabon in Omaha.
So there you go.
That's awesome. Thank you, Mike.
No, sorry. What were you going to say?
No, I was talking about, I was jumping ahead a little bit, but we've got the, you know, the searches of the trucks that are, like, you know, really reminiscent of Gus with his
chicken broth.
No, it's chicken batter. Then the dude who was the truck driver gets his truck all cleared and then drives off, parks on the side of the road, and goes and digs something out of the ground, and we get the patented Breaking Bad, you know, shooting up from below into the clear lucite, you know, thing.
Right.
Yeah, that awesome.
Well, there's
shot.
More that to is- that scene though. That's a hugely long tracking shot. His trip through the border inspection station is all one shot, one take, without cuts.
Oh, wow.
It's reminiscent of Touch of Evil. In fact, Seppenwall talks about it in his article, and he plays the Touch of Evil opening shot, the Orson Welles movie with Charlton Heston. where the tracking shot follows the couple walking down the streets in Tijuana, I think, or some Mexican city. But that shot is a tracking shot. It's uninterrupted all the way from the truck driving through the line and the border through the inspection station. If you notice, the camera kind of went around and then came up from the back. It went around the back of the garage, the warehouse. Yeah,
I noticed it was a really special shot. Like, I didn't realize it was all one take, but it looked really montage-y to me without being a montage.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
Yep, that's why. And then those little sticks spell out something, too. I think they spell out the name of the company. There's a statement, like a company logo or slogan on the truck. And the way the sticks are positioned. Here, I got to find that now for you. It says something. From our house to yours or something.
Yeah, well, it's the company logo is actually embossed on the sticks.
Right, but and so the way that the guys stabbed them into the ground there, like a little stick cemetery,
makes
those words all kind of flow together into the statement of the slogan.
Oh, okay.
God, what is it? Now we got to find out what the hell it is. Okay, so Jamie, on the truck has the name Regalo Helado, gifts frozen gifts. It's an ice cream truck. Uh-huh. And what does it say on it?
Oh.
You had the Spanish.
No, I closed the video.
It says, it means from our family to yours. And it's interesting because they're smuggling something from Mexico, from the family, from the cartel, up to Hector. Something. We don't know what it is yet. It's interesting that we don't know what it is, but we watched their whole process of how they do it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. From our family to yours. And this episode was filmed by Larissa Kondracki. She's directed a couple other Breaking Bads. I don't know if she's done any other Sauls. Probably she has. But this little touch of evil, like opening tracking shot, is really cool. I really liked it.
Yeah, extremely, extremely.
So we don't see much about what is in this truck, so let's talk about it a little bit. The frozen gift, the gift of ice cream truck comes up through the line, gets inspected, he seems to pass, and when he gets to the border, he gets a gun, but we still don't see what's in the truck. It's interesting that he could hide whatever he needed to smuggle in, but he couldn't hide the gun. He had to go get that at a separate location. Maybe the scanner or something could detect a gun.
For sure. For sure, that had to be a big part of it, like, you know, so he keeps his gun buried out there. That was kind of reminiscent of, what was that movie that came out at the same time as There Will Be Blood, but it was the other one that had Javier Bardem in it?
No Country for Old Men?
Yeah, kind of reminiscent of that.
How so?
Because didn't that dude keep his weapons buried out in the desert somewhere, or his money or something? Remember that?
Well, he came upon a bad drug deal gone bad, and then he found a bunch of money and drugs, my money and guns, and then he hid it up in his hiding place was in the vent in the hotel room.
But I thought he had stuff buried out there in the desert, though.
I don't think so. He found it. The guy.
He wouldn't return to the desert, to that same spot in the desert for some reason, like, repeatedly?
Well, he was hunting. That's why he was in the desert. He's a hunter.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember something about, not the main character, not Javier Bardem's character, but, like, that cowboyish dude or something.
Yeah, Josh Brolin.
Yeah, he used to return to the desert for some reason. I don't know. But I love that movie. That was such a good movie.
That's one of my favorite movies. He returns to the crime scene because he feels sorry for the guy who wanted water. He's dying of thirst. Mm. Brings him a gallon of water, and then the bad guys come and find him.
Oh.
But anyway, back to our Better Call Saul. 10 miles in is where he's got that gun secreted, buried in the ground. And he leaves his little popsicle stick there. Now, I thought it was not the greatest thing to do to leave those popsicle sticks, because if anyone ever sees those, that's pretty strong evidence. It's got your company's name on them.
But I guess he figures it's way out that heck, you know, in the middle of nowhere.
Probably safe, yeah. But it seemed a little ceremonial, huh? You put them in the ground like a little parade of popsicle sticks?
Yes.
All right, and then we get the credits. We come back, and Jimmy and Kim are at Jesse's dog hut, the hot dog house.
Yes.
That was awesome. That's another character showing up on the show.
That's correct. I thought it was awesome. Actually, I was so happy, you know, to see that awesome shot from underneath, from, you know, below the ground. And then to see the, you know, the hot dog place. And that was just, I loved it. I loved it so much. Well, it was just really, this was like such a homecoming. And it's really weird to me because, you know, it felt like the first season of Saul really didn't have anything at all of Breaking Bad in it. And, or very little, you know, and of the feel, you know, of Breaking Bad, it felt like a very different show. And, this year, just when I was sort of getting over that yen, you know, that wanting to, you know, to have some sort of connection, you know, they just sort of, it's almost like the floodgates opened up and, you know, they gave, you know, the fans this just huge, delightful experience of memories and, you know, related things and little winks and stuff. It was great. It's
and
great.
Some of the feel that they're bringing back in or letting back in is pretty ominous. Like we see Tuco and all his crime-related family, and even Crazy Eight looks innocent, but you know he's connected to something more ominous that we don't see right on the surface.
Yeah, there was something about the face of that driver. I don't know where I recognize that driver from, but he looks familiar. I'm not saying he was in Breaking Bad, but he looked really oddly, like uncomfortably familiar for me. Like I recognize him, but I don't.
Looked like every other dangerous Mexican cartel transporter.
Are you saying that?
Well, the important scene at the dog hut was Jimmy helping Kim quit the right way and to get the jump on Mesa Verde.
Mm-hmm.
And put the wheels in motion for them to win that account, or for at least Kim to get that account before Howard tries to jump all over it. And we see that Jimmy was right, Jimmy, because the next scene is her, Kim, waiting to see Howard. He's continuing his cold, dickish behavior. he doesn't even want to talk to her, give her a moment, and then doesn't even want to let her in his office. It was pretty cool. We saw his office for the first time, I think. I don't remember ever seeing the inside of his office.
No, we've been in his office a few times. One was when Kim went to try to force him to, you know, to tell her why he wouldn't give Jimmy a chance after Jimmy passed the bar. That was in his office. And that was when he told her to close the door. And then he told her about Chuck, but we didn't see him tell her about Chuck, that Chuck was the one who didn't want Jimmy working at the firm. So we've seen his office before, but not very often.
Well, Jamie, she quits, and I was surprised. I didn't think we would ever get to this point. I always thought something would come up, and their plan to become co-tenant lawyers together in the same building, Jimmy and Kim together, would be short-circuited, but it looks like they're going to actually do it.
It looks like they're going to do it, but I don't know if it's not going to be short-circuited. I think it probably will be short-circuited still.
Yeah, I was actually surprised, though, when she actually literally went through it with it, and she quit. So Howard first thinks it's the Schweiger and Coakley deal. Are they going to hire you? You're going to jump ship with them. He knows about it somehow. But no, she's on her own. She's going to do this, start her own firm.
Yep. She's not going to Schweikert. She is going to start her own.
So Howard thinks it's an odd coincidence that both she and Jimmy had quit at the same time. And she tries to be pretty grateful with him. She's pretty gracious with this whole thing. He gives her the school loan. He forgives that loan. So that's just like a gift, pretty nice gift. And then he expresses that he's envious of her fresh start,
mm-hmm.
about how he wanted it, but his dad talked him out of it, and that was the third H. So we learn a little bit more about Howard here.
What's the third H?
The HHM, or the second H, I guess. Sorry, third letter.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's the second H. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. We never knew that, though. Never knew really what this second H was.
Right. Well, I mean, I kind of figured, but yes, you're right. No one ever said anything.
So Howard gives her some final words. He says he pushed her harder because he always knew she was capable. And then as she's leaving, she pauses for a moment outside the door, takes a deep breath, and she hears Howard request a meeting with Mesa Verde. So Jimmy was right. She sprints to her phone to call. It looked like to be just in time to call before things blew up with Kevin and Paige.
That's right.
All right, so Jamie, then we see the truck making its deliveries, and it's to Tio's restaurant, or the restaurant where he's hanging out. I guess that's his business, huh?
I guess.
We've seen him in there a few times, and now we've seen him in there at night, kind of after hours, so I'm guessing that's his business.
Yeah.
And we see Mike observing all of this.
Mike is watching all.
He's seeing it all, yeah. All right, now back to Kim and Paige and Kevin. She gives her pitch and to keep them, to take them with her after she's left HHM. And she makes the, your suit is tailor-made for a reason. And that's my analogy to you, is my service to you would be tailor-made to you, and you would get all of my attention, and I can do a great job. She really does a great pitch here. She's a good saleswoman.
Yep. Something she has in common with Jimmy.
Yeah, and Chuck, actually. Chuck's a good salesman. We'll see later on.
Mm-hmm.
So Kim meets then with Jimmy and Steve, the I guess the realtor in the dentist office that they're going to rent as their legal office. And she looks reluctant. So I had this thing kind of I thought was hanging over this mood, hanging over it, like something's going to go wrong. And she seemed really reluctant, but maybe not. She just relays the news how she kicked ass during the lunch meeting. And she kind of fakes us out there a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like there was something foreboding about that. But I still feel that sense of foreboding, even though Jimmy has sort of, you know, taken the burden off of her for the time being. I still feel at the end of this episode that this is a doomed partnership, sort of partnership.
Well, we kind of know that by just knowing the history.
No, I don't mean it like that. Because, you know, honestly, they could be in business successfully and happily together for the next, you know, 5 years. But I think it falls apart soon.
Yeah, you're saying it's kind of doomed before it ever gets started.
Yes.
I think so, too. I think we're supposed to feel that way. So, yeah. Jamie, now, in this episode, everybody's wearing blue. What's the meaning of this?
All right, so I hate to do it, but I'm going to say that I'm not sure.
You hate to admit you're not sure.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that my color theory necessarily plays across the landscape of Saul the way that it did across Breaking Bad.
Well, Gilligan says it does. I mean, he picked up the red. He pointed out the red meaning crime in Saul.
Yeah, okay. So, but my color theory is, like, way deeper than that. Like, it goes, like, you can split colors and you can still come up with, like, meaning. So it's just, it's really complex. Like, for example, in Breaking Bad, blue is protection, right? Red is danger. That's the way I had it figured. It's like red is danger, not crime or something like that. But like Marie, right, she wears purple. Purple is a combination of red and blue. You know, danger because, you know, of Hank, right? And protection because of Hank. And, you know, like she's always in danger with the law because she's a freaking thief. And she's always doing something to get herself in trouble. And so her husband's always, you know, pulling her out of that. But it's just interesting to me. It's like really cool because her whole house is purple. Like everything she has is covered in purple, you know, which is like, to me, it's symbolic of, you know, Hank's job and, you know, a person's home typically being where they're safe. You know, so the combination of red and blue would be purple, like everywhere. And then after Hank dies, the purple's gone.
Hmm.
There's no purple anywhere.
In this episode, everybody's wearing blue, including down to Mike and Stacy. I think Howard's tie is blue. It's got to mean something. I haven't listened to the Insider podcast yet. Maybe they'll talk about it.
I don't know if they'll talk about it. I don't know if they even address those things very fully. I think they I think that they like to leave some of that to the audience to figure out. But you're right. There was, I didn't think about it while I was watching it. But it's interesting that you say that, because the opening of the show, the tie that was on the ground in the desert was also blue. It's like blue striped.
Okay. Well, I just noticed they're both Jimmy and Kim, while they're looking around this dentist office to consider it for their space, were both wearing blue. So we go to Chuck now. Chuck's humming and working alone by himself, and Howard visits him and warns him that they're losing Mesa Verde to Kim and Jimmy pooling their efforts together. And Chuck says, "That guy, he's Svengali." Mm-hmm. He thinks Jimmy's behind it. But Howard has one more chance. He has one more meeting with Kevin at the bank to try to sway it. And he asks for some advice from Chuck, some memos or some notes or some advice about what to say. And Chuck says, "Nope, I'm going with you." And he puts on his normal suit, and he's going to go out into the world without his defense mode, Jamie. I'm a little tired of this act, this radiation or whatever he's afraid of, electromagnetic field act that he has.
Yeah, I don't know. It just feels to me like something's got to break with that thing.
I know it's not an act to him. I know he really feels pain, but I'm tired of it. Just tired of it. And plus, I'm starting to, like I told you previously, I don't like Chuck very much just because of the way he picks on Jimmy.
Oh, yeah.
So they have the meeting with Kevin and Paige, and Chuck compliments Kevin on choosing Kim. It's a left-handed compliment. It's a whole left-handed presentation that everybody is aware of, that he's making a pitch for HHM, really, by congratulating Kim. You really need a kick in the pants. We're just stale old guys who know. All we do is read SEC and compliance documents for fun and other boring things that, you know, other people would be bored to tears with. But you're in excellent hands. You get an exciting new representative that's going to give you a kick in the pants. And
is that what that's called, a left-handed presentation?
Well, a left-handed compliment.
Oh.
It's like, it's, you know, you've heard that before, right?
I've heard left-handed compliment, but I thought it was really clever what you said, left-handed presentation, you know, which is pretty much, you know, like I thought that's the way you were characterizing what Chuck was actually doing, like presenting this information to them.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I just put the word left-handed in front of his whole presentation, because his whole presentation was in that mode.
Yeah, clever dude. I like it.
Thanks. And so your bank's in excellent hands. And so Kevin knows what he's up to, and he just says, "I think she can do it." And Chuck says, "Well, consider a team of pros, not just one person alone." And it registers with Kevin, because we're going to see what he ends up doing. But right after this meeting, Chuck gets really ill in the lobby. He can't take being out in the world with this electromagnetism all around him, I guess. And then next scene, Jamie, we see Jimmy wheeling an old vet out to Fifi the bomber. Fifi the World War II bomber. We don't know yet how this is going to fit into this plot, into the story, but it's a pretty cool old plane.
Yes, it really was. And I didn't expect that to be Fifi.
No, I didn't either. I thought it was, like we said, the little fox on Kaylee's shirt that we see later on. Maybe that was a Fifi. Mm-hmm. I thought that might have been a dog or something. But no, it's the bomber. And they're showing the bomber to old Theodore Fudge Talbot, a World War II hero. And he's with his video boys. But it's really an actor. He's an old defendant caught doing some public masturbation that Jimmy had to get off the hook.
Yeah.
And they're making a movie, a little video of some sort of advertisement that Jimmy's going to use. And again, that's something else we don't really know what it's for, but it's interesting to watch them do it.
Yes.
And they use the dolly. Their dolly this time is the wheelchair that the guy was in.
Right.
Now, this old guy is a pretty good historian, because he knows that bomber was used to fight the Japanese and not the Nazis. Jimmy's trying to be the director and getting them all in the method acting mode of just like, okay, you're in the war, you're fighting the Nazis. He's like, no, this plane was used in the Pacific to fight the Japanese, not the Nazis.
Yeah.
Jimmy gets a call from Ernie that Chuck's doing poorly. And when this team, and then a team of soldiers comes out to get their picture taken. But I thought this team of soldiers was going to arrest these guys. I thought they were there to catch them doing what they were doing. Did you get that when you first saw those guys marching out?
Yes, that's what I thought. Yes, I thought that they were there to arrest them or something.
Yeah, it looks bad, but they just want a picture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now Kim's doing her smoking routine at the dentist office, just like the parking garage. She's sitting outside on the sidewalk having a cigarette. It's her meditation, I think, having a cigarette.
Yeah, I think, yes, that's actually really smart. Yes, I think you're right.
Well, Kim's doing her meditation routine with her cigarette outside, and it's really because of bad news. Kevin has switched back to Mesa Verde's going to stick with HHM and not go to Kim Wexler's legal company.
Right. And okay, so she looks, first of all, can I just say, I really don't like that they have Kim smoking. I know it's like counter politically correct, right? Like they're, you know, I mean, she smokes, you know, but I just hate it. I hate that so much. And I feel really bad for her. And actually, I really sympathized a lot with Kim in that moment, because I don't know how you see me. I don't know how our listeners see me, but I feel like I have a lot of really, really good luck in my life. Like I have a lot of good things happen to me. But if you look at my life, like as a whole, I've had a hell of a lot of bad luck. And so I can really identify with that feeling that she must, like when I saw her sitting there, it was really evocative to me of like, there was empathy. Like I went into an emotion about that. Like I could really identify with where her head must have been in that moment.
Interesting. That's an interesting comment. Yeah, she was, I don't know if I'd call it bad luck, though, because she was, you know, there were people doing things to make this switch of the law team decision. It was all done by things that actually people did. It wasn't lucky or unlucky.
Well, yeah, okay. But I don't know. I think of, I don't know, I'm a fatalist in a way. I believe in effort and I believe in people trying, but I do believe that things happen for a reason a lot of the time, inexplicably. And so when I think of a situation like that, that's what I mean. Like, you know, it doesn't matter what she did. She tried. She tried her hardest, but it didn't work out in her favor.
Right. It'll work out for her in the long run, though, because you can just tell that she's kind of a plugger, right? She's going to keep trying like she did when she got this company in the first place. She had to make a bunch of calls in the stairwell and she just worked hard to get it. She'll work hard again and get it.
I hope so.
All right. She tells Jimmy that it was Chuck behind it, and then asks Jimmy if he's up for still doing this whole thing, just doing this whole office thing together.
Uh-huh.
And Jimmy encourages her, and he's a really good coach. We're a team. We're here to help each other. And he convinces her, but then the camera shows a bit of reflection on his face that shows that he's got a little bit of a deflated look on his face.
Oh, no, I didn't take it that way. I will tell you how I took it. I took it that he was, first of all, I mean, A+ for Jimmy in this scene. He really had her back. And that's like, I'm an independent person. Like, I really fight for what I'm supposed to have, you know, like I try to, well, I mean, yeah, it's just me. Like I, you know, I fight for what I get. But when you're defeated in a moment like that, and it can feel really black. It can feel like a bad spot. Like how the heck am I going to dig myself out of this thing? And to have somebody be there and say, hey, you know what? I'm here for you. Like I've got you. Right.
Yeah,
now.
Even it doesn't matter what they do, just that feeling of having a collaborator that says, hey, I got your back. We're here to help each other. That knowledge in and of itself is sometimes all you need.
That is a hell of a feeling. That's like really, I mean, that's one of the best things in life is like realizing you're not alone when you think you are.
Right.
That's amazing. It's amazing. And so he got, I mean, huge, huge points with me for that moment. And when Kim got up, dusted herself off and walked into the building, that look on Jimmy's face that you said looked kind of deflated, that looked angry to me. I thought he was angry, and I think that's when he made that plan in his head about what he was going to do.
Well, you're probably right in reflection now after having seen the episode that you're probably right about that. He probably is like, that fucker, I'm going to get him this time.
Mm-hmm. And not feel bad about it.
Yeah. All right, next we see Mike following Hector to some old warehouse lot where his cool old car gets the frozen gifts cargo, the whatever was in the truck. They close the door, so they're keeping that a secret from us, Jamie, while Hector waits outside. I thought for a moment Hector was going to see Mike sitting in his car and violate my, you can sit anywhere in a car in a TV show and be invisible.
All right. So, you know, you have actually pointed this out to me, and it is becoming my pet peeve now because now I see it. And I used to see it before in the past. But I would always be confused, like, maybe there's something I'm missing. Like, I don't understand that in TV universe, like, this is okay. And so I never really got irritated with it. But, like, when I saw it today and yesterday, I was just like, no. Why doesn't he see Mike sitting there?
I think they have to do it for the story, for us as viewers to see us. We see both Mike and Hector in the same time, in the same frame. Otherwise, it'd be hard if Hector couldn't see Mike, but Mike could see him, and then we have to see them both somehow. And we see that in The Americans. They're, you know, Stan's spying on people. It's just easier, I think, for the audience to see what's going on.
I guess, but I mean, God, it is really irritating. It's really, because you're like, okay, he's right there.
Yeah. You remember Breaking Bad, Hank did it all the time. He would sit like on Jesse's street, just sit in his car with all his snacks and his colas and stuff, and no one would ever notice him. Right. All right, so Mike's following him and sees his car get the treatment in this garage, but he doesn't know what's going on the inside of the closed door. So Jimmy gets home now in the dark to see Chuck, and Ernie's watching over him. And Jamie, when he excuses Ernie, did you ever wonder if Jimmy could do something harmful to Chuck?
Nah.
I thought about it for a second here, because Chuck's pretty helpless here. He's shivering under his aluminum foil blanket. But all Jimmy wants to do, it's not physically harmful, I guess, but it is somewhat harmful. He goes through his notes and his files, and he figures out what he wants to do as a strategy to kind of undermine this whole Mesa Verde case. And he makes some creative edits on a few documents, on some architects' documents, maps, vendor files and stuff, all in regard to Mesa Verde. So he changes an address. What do you think that's going to do to their case?
All right, so it's the Mesa Verde Bank address. And so he's switching it from 61 to 16. I think it'll delay something, but I don't know what, because these are like communications to Mesa Verde's customers, I think. I'm not sure what those were, but what it could have an effect of doing is delaying whatever it is that these people are mailing to the bank. Because if they're mailing it to the wrong address, then, you know, if it's money, it's going to get there late. If it's contracts, they could get lost in the mail. So the bank could lose customers, or it could make HHM look really unprofessional. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be a few things. It could be because Chuck just pitched to Kevin that we have a whole team. We know we're super professional. We pore over documents. We know documents left and right, up and down. And so it would be like some staffer, some low-level person at HHM making a typo. And Kim, that could come into Kim's favor, where she would say, you know, I don't have low-level staffers. I am the one looking over everything, and I would not have made a low-level mistake like this.
Right.
The other side of that is it could be because Kim was reviewing documents that maybe it'll come back to bite Kim because she may get blamed for this mistake.
Oh.
Wasn't she in document review? I don't know if the bank was in the document review period of time that Kim was stuck in document review.
Well, okay, so... Yeah, I mean, she was. She was. That was when she landed them, was when she was still in doc review. She landed them during that time. So
I don't. And then she had to stay in document review even after landing them. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it could come back to bite Kim then. Like, well, Kim was in document review when these mistakes passed through her. I don't know.
Yeah.
The point is Jimmy's doing something that she doesn't know about, and then she's going to be involved with it, that, you know, he's doing his colorful lawyering that she doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't know. It's just interesting.
It is. I wonder what it's going to end up to be. Yeah, and you're right. It's going to come back to bite her.
Something's going to come back to bite her for sure. Unless she's already lost this account and she's just not... I mean, she's already lost it. What does she have to lose more?
Well, you know, like what you're saying. I mean, if Jimmy did that to make the firm look bad, to make HHM look bad, but Kim was the person who should have been reviewing those documents and finding mistakes, then it's going to come back and look bad on Kim. And if it costs HHM money, or if it costs them their client, they may come back at Kim. You know, maybe they'll sue her. I don't know.
Maybe. Or, you know, at least ruin her legal reputation.
Yeah.
All right, Jimmy goes back to replace the documents where he's cleverly marked that they all go in various places, numerous locations in Chuck's files, and then checks on Chuck and confronts him on Mesa Verde. And Chuck pretty much dismisses him, but then he thanks him, too. Interesting. Interesting big brotherly thing here with Chuck and Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jimmy, Mike's making a sprinkler project with Kaylee. She's learned about fractions in school. I thought we were going to get some half measures, full measures here.
Ah, man, that would have been awesome.
But Mike says she's smarter than he was when he was in school. And Kaylee gives him a little wisdom here. She says, maybe you just needed better teachers.
I loved that line. That, to me, was a line straight out of the golden pens of the writers of this show. I think that they were giving a little love to the teaching profession. I loved it.
Then he lets her drill a little bit. I was kind of worried when she was drilling. She's going to drill through her hand or something.
Nah.
Not with Grandpa Mike pop watching her.
That's right.
This is where I noticed Mike wearing blue and Stacy had on her blue nurse's pants.
Yeah, you're right. There was a whole lot of blue going on.
And then later on, watching a Cary Grant movie, Mike makes a spike strip out of that hose. It wasn't for watering his rhododendrons or whatever he says.
Right.
It's for Tio and the ice cream truck or something.
Something.
What do you think he's up to?
I think that Mike is going to stop that truck, and I think he's going to figure out what's in that truck.
Why doesn't Mike just live and let live? He's kind of gotten out of trouble with Tio for the moment.
I think that Mike knows that his troubles with that family will never end until he's dead or one of them's dead or somebody's been put in their place and is scared to make a move against Mike. I think Mike knows that he's got to take care of himself. He's got to be preemptive. He's got to be prescriptive.
Well, spoiler alert, we know that Hector and Mike both survive into the future. So whatever he's doing, if it's to kill Hector or get him in trouble or kill Tuco or get him in more trouble, it's probably not going to work.
What?
Right, because they're both we know that they're coexisting in the future.
No, they're not. I'm kidding. Yeah, I know.
All right, Jamie, that's it for 208 Fifi. Next week is 209 Nailed. What could that be?
I don't know, but I'm sad that he didn't say Better Call Saul this episode.
Who didn't say Better Call Saul?
Jimmy.
What do you mean?
Remember, I told you, I predicted.
He would become Saul.
that he would say it, that he would eventually say it. I thought he was going to do that commercial and not have any kind of really, like, cool way to do it, and then he was going to finally be like, Better call Saul. But it didn't work.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll hear him say that in this. He said it in the very first season, the very beginning, right, with Marco.
All he said was Saul Goodman.
Saul Goodman. Right.
Yeah. So, okay, so nailed. I figure that's like Mike's little spiky thing, right?
Yeah, I was kidding. I said, can you guess what that is?
Oh, and click, K-L-I-C-K, I don't know.
The preview for Nailed says Mike takes a methodical approach to his mission, and someone questions Chuck's capabilities. Jimmy faces a personal dilemma. Jimmy, that you could say that about every episode.
Yeah, that's way too general.
Someone questioning Chuck's capabilities could have something to do with those incorrect addresses on those documents.
Oh, that's definitely what it is.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right, Jimmy, how do people reach you before 209 Nailed if they want to send you a tweet?
I'm on Twitter, and I'm @WordGirly.
And I'm @ScathingTweets. So until 209, that's it for Fifi.
Such a weird episode name.
Yeah, what could that bomber be in Jimmy's legal endeavors? Helping veterans, helping old people?
He's pretty self-serving. I don't know. I don't know what that thing is, but I think I don't think we're done with that. I think that there's something left to that story, because otherwise that was kind of really like a non sequitur.
It's something for something to help elderly people as a lawyer. Like if you got in trouble with, I don't know, asbestos seats on your military duty by riding in a bomber, call Better Call Saul. I don't know.
You could be totally right.
No, it's something for the elderly people, because that's a good American patriotic commercial. A World War II vet, old guy.
True.
Getting celebrated by Jimmy McGill. All right, Jimmy, we'll see.
Yes, we will.
All right. We'll see you next week, everybody. Bye.
Bye.